Welcome. Thank you for joining me. Hope everything is going well with you and your family. I would like to start session 5 in the history of socialism. And I start with deconstruction. In more recent times, there's been an adaption of a socialist tactic they call deconstruction. This is where a country's past heroes are portrayed in a negative light, so that people emotionally detach from them and their values. Then there's a period of disillusionment and searching. Finally, there's an introduction or rewritten history with socialist values. Dystopian writer George Orwell explained in 1984, every record has been destroyed or falsified, every book rewritten, every picture has been repainted, every statue and street building has been renamed, every date has been altered. And the process is continuing day by day and minute by minute. History has stopped. Nothing exists except an endless present in which the party is always right. I know, of course, the past is falsified, but it would never be possible for me to prove it, even if I did the falsification myself. After the thing is done, no evidence ever remains. The only evidence is inside my own mind, and I don't know with any certainty than any other human being shares my memories. Orwell explained how to alter a nation's trajectory. Those who control the past control the future. Those who control the present control the past. It's actually a sales technique. First, a salesman points out a negative aspect of an old product the customer is using. Then the customer becomes dissatisfied with it and is curious about new options. Then the salesman presents positive aspects of a new product. Deconstruction does this on a national scale. The deconstruction drive neutral reverse method is also accomplished in the classroom. Separate students from their past by portraying negatively the country's founders. Get students into a neutral point of view where they are open-minded. Then brainwash students by presenting positively a socialist future. Socialist historian Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, 1980, is of this genre. Senate chaplain Peter Marshall said of the deconstruction, along with our higher education came a debunking contest, a sort of national sport. It was smarter to revile than to revere, more fashionable to deprecate than to appreciate. Debunking is a sign of a decaying foundation. Cognitive psychologists have carried out experiments where researchers can actually implant false memories in people's minds, making people believe that they remember events that never actually occurred. This can be done on a national level. Deconstruction or cancel culture involves selectively re-editing or re-ridiculing past individuals or events in order to advance a future political agenda. Altering a nation's past in order to change its future. In a 1975 movie, Monty Python and the Holy Grail was in this vein, mocking the legendary King Arthur and England's noble history. A scriptwriter for Hollywood sitcoms confided how they were instructed to make them laugh at what they hold sacred, and one can't be proud of something he's ashamed of. Separating people from their past is mentioned in a quote attributed to Karl Marx, "Take away the heritage of a people, and they are easily conquered." Yang Berhorma, Minister of Culture of Borneo, wrote in the Brunei Times, August 29, 2013, "A nation or generation that does not know the history of their nation is a nation that has lost its identity and can be easily manipulated." This is why the first emperor of China, King Qi Huangdi, who conquered kingdoms to unify China in 221 BC, destroyed all history books. The Basic Annals of the First Emperor of Qin reported Chancellor Li Si told the emperor in 213 BC, "I, your servant, propose that all historians' records other than those of Qin's be burned. If anyone under heaven has copies of classics of history, they shall deliver them to the governor for burning. Anyone who dares discuss the classics of history shall be publicly executed. Anyone who uses history to criticize the present shall have his family executed. Anyone who has failed to burn the books after 30 days of this announcement shall be subjected to tattooing and be sent to build the Great Wall. President Jimmy Carter started the Department of Education in 1979. And from that time on, proficiency in math, literature, and history began to decline. Lawrence W. Reed examined this trend in his article, The Myth That Americans Were Poorly Educated Before Mass Government Schooling. Solzhenitsyn stated, if we don't know our own history, we simply have to endure the same mistakes, sacrifices, and absurdities all over again. The opposite of individuals owning property is social ownership of property, which in application is no different from feudal lord holding the land in trust and dividing it among his loyal knights and vassals, who in turn collect taxes from the poor peasants. Webster's 1828 dictionary defined property as the exclusive right of possessing, enjoying, and disposing of a thing, ownership. In the beginning of the world, the Creator gave to man dominion over the earth. It is one of the greatest blessings of civil society that property of citizens is well secured. When John Locke believed the natural law affirmed private property rights existed prior to the formation of any state, Jean-Jacques Rousseau believed the state's social contract preceded property rights. Socialist writers such as Plato, Sir Thomas More, Sir Francis Bacon, and others advocated social ownership of property or communal property. Karl Marx wrote, the theory of communists may be summed up in a single sentence, abolition of private property. AFL-ACLU founder Roger Baldwin wrote in 1939 at his Harvard class 30th reunion, I am for socialism. I seek social ownership of property. Reagan explained in October 1964 how government regulations effectively take away property. Now, it doesn't require confiscation of private property or business to impose socialism. What it means is whether you hold the deed to the property or business, machinery always exists where the government can find some charge to bring against a concern, any concern it chooses to prosecute. Every businessman has his own tale of harassment. What does the Bible say about property? Throughout scriptures, God gives men and women property to be stewards over. Genesis 2:15 states the Lord God took man and put him into the Garden Eden to work and to keep it. Abraham purchased a lot of land in which to bury his wife, Sarah. Moses divided up promised land into property, family rights, inherited by children. Boaz brought the field from Naomi. At this, Boaz said to the elders and all of his people, you are witness today that I am buying from Naomi all that belongeth to Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon, Ruth 4:9. Ten Commandments confirm private property ownership with the command, thou shalt not steal the property of another, nor shalt thou covet thy neighbor's property, nor shalt thou covet thy neighbor's house, his field, his ox, or anything that is thy neighbor's. It is not lawful for me to do. And Jesus explained in the parable, friend, I do thee no wrong. Didst not thou agree with me for a penny? Take that thine is, and go thy way. I give to unto thee this last, even unto thee. Is it not lawful for me to do with what I will with mine own? Is thine eye evil because I am good? It is criminal for an employer to hold back a worker's wages. Thou shalt not defraud thy neighbor, neither rob him. The wages of him that is hired shall not abide with thee all night until morning. And behold, the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth, and cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of hosts. John Adams explained in defense of the constitutions of government of the United States, the consequence of private property is not protected. Property is surely a right of mankind. Perhaps at first, principle or religion would restrain the poor from attacking the rich, but for the time would not be long before courage and enterprise would come and pretexts be invented by degrees to countenance the majority in dividing all the property among them, or at least in sharing it equally with its present possessors. debts would be abolished first, taxes laid heavy on the rich, and not on all the others, and at least a downright equal division of everything is demanded and voted. Adams continued, what would be the consequence of this? The idle, vicious, intemperate would rush into the utmost extravagance of debauchery, sell and spend all they share, and then demand a new division of those purchased from them, who purchased them from them. The moment the idea is admitted into society that property is not as sacred as the laws of God, and there is not a force of law and public justice to protect it, anarchy and tyranny commence. If thou shalt not covet, and thou shalt not steal, were not commandments of heaven, they must be made inviolable, secure precepts in every society before it can be civilized and made free. When government gives anything out, it is in exchange for something. When there is a famine in Egypt, the government gave grain in exchange for the people's freedom, their lives, their children. When the government gives anything, whether it be recipient, receives it or not, it is in exchange for something, such as freedoms, political loyalty, or votes. As well-intentioned as government programs may be, they are not run by career politicians and bureaucrats who have an inherent conflict of interests. In addition to running the program, they do not want the program to end, as they would lose justification for their jobs. If a politician is popular because he champions the needs of the poor, he has a vested interest in continuation of the poor staying poor as a voting constituency. If the poor were no longer poor, he would lose his voting bloc and may not get reelected. In other words, they want the poor to stay poor. For 30 years, our nation spent $5 trillion trying to erase poverty, and as a result, as you know, is that we didn't get rid of it at all. In fact, we spread it. We destroyed the self-esteem of millions of people, grinding them down in a welfare system that penalizes moms for wanting to marry their father or their children, and penalizes moms for wanting to save money. Friends, that's not right. Politicians may also be tempted to redirect public funds as favors and pork projects to loyal party members and supporters who may help them stay in office. James Buchanan Jr. received Nobel Prize in Economics in 1896 for his examination of how politicians make economy policy decisions. He discovered that if politicians are up for re-election, they tend to vote to increase their debt so that they can direct money to their districts, as they will help them get re-elected. If they will not vote for corresponding tax increases to pay for it, this will result in their re-election. So a large percentage of career bureaucrats are primarily interested in self-preservation. Government employees are tempted to use their positions to perpetuate their jobs while harassing, auditing, and leaking, investigating or prosecuting those who would threaten to eliminate their jobs. Reagan stated in October 1964, no government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size. So government programs, once launched, never disappear. Actually, the government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life that we've ever seen on earth. An overlooked biblical teaching is that God gives commands to five major entities: individuals, families, employers, employees, churches, and government. Individuals are told, among other things, to be charitable to the poor, to visit the sick in prison, to act like the Good Samaritan. Families are to give relational commands, such as husbands, love your wives, children, submit to your parents, provide for those of your own household. Employers are told not to hold back wages, and employees are told to give an honest day's work. Churches, among other things, are told to be charitable, feed the hungry, visit the sick and the imprisoned, take care of the poor, infirm, widows, orphans, maimed soldiers, unwed mothers, shut-ins, homeless, juvenile delinquents, and immigrants. Historically, churches have fulfilled this command, starting hospitals, orphanages, missions, schools, universities, and other Christian organizations, with some even vowing to give their lives in such service. The government has the shortest command, namely to protect the innocent and punish the guilty. There is no biblical command for government to help the poor, take care of the sick, dispense health care, operate schools, provide jobs, or other entitlements. Naive voters, politicians, and church leaders get these five categories mixed up. Many churches have neglected responsibilities only to have the government usurp them. Just because something needs to be done does not mean that the government's job to do it. Charity is no part of legislative duty of government. Davy Crockett served three terms in the U.S. Congress between 1827 and 1835 before dying in Texas Alamo, when Congress was debating whether to use taxes collected by citizens to redistribute to someone in need. Davy Crockett gave a speech, "Not Yours to Give." Congress has no power to appropriate this money as an act of charity. Every member of this floor knows it. We have the right as individuals to give away much of our own money as we please in charity, but as members of Congress, we have no right to appropriate a dollar of the public money. He said, I'll give a week's paycheck to this object, and if every member of Congress does the same, we'll have the amount needed. President Grover Cleveland opposed federal welfare. Federal aid in such cases, he says, encourages the expectation of a paternal care on the part of the government and weakens the assertiveness of our national character, while it prevents, among other people, of that kindly sentiment, which strengthens a bond of common brotherhood. Water seeks its own level. It will always leak through a crack or find its way downhill, no matter what form of government a selfish person will try to manipulate it for their own benefit. A final, Senator Ted Cruz discussed with Fox News, Maria Barrett-Teromo, on January 20th, 2020, a handful of Silicon Valley billionaires have an ability to censor, deceive, and manipulate votes. Liberal investors buy stock in major corporations in order to introduce at stock shareholder meetings leftist resolutions promoting issues such as LGBTQ, BLM, and abortion, and subjecting employees to diverse training and shaming. A final disturbing development are globalist capitalists who believe the world is overpopulated and seek to use their financial influence to reduce population. In 2018, Bill Gates stated, first we've got population. The world today has 6.8 billion people. Now, if we do a great job on new vaccines, healthcare, and reproductive health services, we could lower perhaps 10 to 15%. Naive students taught that communist countries, everyone owns everything equally. From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs, wrote Karl Marx. But does this ever happen? Who decides what one's ability is or what one's needs are? A question needs to be asked. Who decides who lives in a nice house and who lives in a dumpy house? The answer is someone in government dictates those things. Well, whoever ultimately dictates those things is the dictator. In practice, socialism and communism are nothing more than a monarchy makeover, a top-down system of government control, where the supreme leader focuses a will on the others. In other words, the government gets everything and the people get nothing. It never gets redistributed. President Harrison warned, the danger to all the well-established free governments arises from the willingness of people to believe in the influence of designing men. This is an old trick of those who would usurp the government of their own country. In the name of democracy, they speak warning the people against influence of wealth and the danger of aristocracy. History, ancient and modern, is full of such examples. It behooves the people to be most watchful of those of to whom they have entrusted power. Harrison added, the great dread seems to have been a consolidation of power, that government be essentially radically changed. President Eisenhower stated, in 1957, the national government was itself a creature that states, yet of the states. Yet today, it's often made to appear that the creature, Frankenstein-like, is determined to destroy the creators. Reagan stated, all of us need to be reminded that the federal government did not create the states. The states created the federal government. And President Gerald Ford remarked in 1975, a government too large and bureaucratic can stifle individual initiative by frustrating statism. In America, our sovereign is the citizen, and we must never forget it. Governments exist to serve people. The state is the creature of the populace. Woodrow Wilson addressed the New York Press Club. He said, the history of liberty is a history of the limitation of government power, not the increase of it. President Obama intended not to be limited by constitutional checks and balances in January 14th, 2014. He says, we are not just going to be waiting for legislation. I've got a pen. I've got a phone. I can use that pen and phone to sign executive orders. Holding the opposite view, President Trump stated, today we are not merely transferring power of one administration to another or from one party to another. We are transferring the power from Washington, D.C., and giving it back to you, the American people. In January 20th, 2017, will be remembered the day that the people became rulers of this nation again. John Jay was a Continental Congress president and later nominated by George Washington as a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He wrote in 1777, "The Americans are the first people whom heaven has favored with an opportunity of choosing the forms of government under which they should live. All other constitutions have derived their existence from violence or accidental circumstances. Your lives, your liberties, your property will be at the disposal only of your Creator and yourselves." Signer of Declaration in the Constitution, James Wilson, was appointed to the Supreme Court by George Washington. Wilson stated in 1787, "After a period of 6,000 years since the creation, the United States exhibit to the world the first instance of a nation assembling voluntarily and deciding that system of government under which they will be and their posterity should live." Daniel Webster, senator, stated in 1802, "Miracles do not cluster, and what has happened once in 6,000 years may not happen again. Hold on to the Constitution, for if the American Constitution should fail, there will be anarchy throughout the world." Why would Webster say that there will be anarchy throughout the world? If the Constitution fail, because from the beginning of history, vast numbers of men and women have suffered under dictators, dreaming of the chance to rule themselves without a king. If Americans blow it, what should be left for suffering humanity to hope for? Yale President Ezra Stiles said in 1788, "All the forms of civil polity have been tried by mankind except one." And that seems to have been reserved in Providence to be realized in America. At the time of the Revolutionary War, nearly every other country on earth was ruled by a king. Pat Robertson wrote in American States on Destiny, September 17, 1787, the day of our Constitution was signed, the absolute monarch, Qianlong, Emperor of Manchu Dynasty, reigned supreme over the people of China. Revolts were put down by ruthless military force. In Japan, the shogun's warriors of the corrupt Tokugawa Chamberlain Tanuma Akitsugu exercised corrupt and totalitarian authority over the Japanese. In India, Warren Hastings, the British governor of Bengal, had successfully defeated the influence of the fragmented Mongol dynasties that ruled India since 1600. Catherine II was enlightened despot of the Russians. Joseph II was emperor of Austria, Bohemia, and Hungary. For almost half a century, Frederick the Great had ruled Prussia. Louis XVI sat uneasily on the throne of France just years away from a bloody revolution, the tyranny of Napoleon Bonaparte. A kind of constitutional government had been created in the Netherlands by the Protestant Union of Utrecht, but that constitution was really a loose federation of northern provinces for the defense against Catholic Spain. What happened in America had no real precedent. Even as far back as the city-states of Greece, the only real precedent was established thousands of years before in the tribes of Israel in the covenant with God and with each other. President Theodore Roosevelt stated in 1903, "In no other place, at no other time, has the experiment of government of the people, by the people, for the people, been tried on so vast a scale as here in our own country." President Calvin Coolidge stated in 1924, "The history of the government of this earth has been almost entirely rule of force held by in the hands of a few. Under our Constitution, America committed itself to power in the hands of the people. America is a republic where the people are the king, ruling over through representatives. When someone protests a flag, they are saying they no longer want to be king. They protest a system where they participate in ruling themselves, evidently wanting someone to." Ronald Reagan opened the Ashbrook Center in Ashland, Ohio on May 9th in 1983. From their own harsh experience with intrusive, overbearing government, the founding fathers made a great breakthrough in political understanding. They understood that it is excesses in government, the will to power of one man over another, that has been the principal source of injustice and human suffering throughout the ages. The founding fathers understood that only by making the government the servant, not the master, only depositing sovereignty in the people and not the state, can we hope to protect freedom and see the political commonwealth prosper. In 1776, the source of government excess was the Crown's abuse of power and its attempt to suffocate the colonists with its overbearing demands. In our own day, the danger of too much state power has taken a subtler, more or less dangerous form, John Adams wrote in notes in a dissertation on canon law and feudal law. I always consider the settlement of America as the opening of the grand scene of design and providence for the emancipation and slavish part of mankind over all the earth. John Jay noted in 1777, this glorious revolution, distinguished by so many marks of divine favor and interposition, and I may say miraculous, that when the future ages shall read its history, they will be tempted to consider a great part of it as fabulous. The many remarkable events which our wants have been supplied and our enemies repelled are such strong and striking proofs of the interposition of heaven that our having been hitherto delivered from the threatened bondage of Britain ought, like emancipation of the Jews from Egyptian servitude. Franklin Roosevelt stated in 1939, rulers increase their power over the common men. The seamen have to find their goal, have found instead their way of escape for the common man from those rulers. What they have found over the western horizon was not silk and jewels of Cathay, but mankind's second chance, a chance to create a new world after he almost spoiled the old one. The Almighty seems purposely to have withheld that second chance until the time when the men would most need and appreciate it. Ronald Reagan in 1961 stated, in this country of ours took place the greatest revolution that has ever taken place in world history. Every other revolution simply exchanged one set of rulers for another. Here, for the first time in all the thousands of years of man's relation to man, the founding fathers established the idea that you and I had within ourselves the God-given right and ability to determine our own destiny. This idea that government is beholden to the people, that it has no other source of power except the sovereign people, it is still the newest and most unique idea in all the history of mankind's relationship to man. British Edwardian writer Chesterton stated, what is America? America is the only nation in the world that is founded on creed. That creed is set forth in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are equal. Their claim to injustice, that governments exist to give them that justice. It certainly does condemn atheism, since it equally names the Creator as the ultimate authority with whom all these equal rights are derived. Calvin Coolidge stated in 1926, the principles which went into the Declaration of Independence are found in the sermons of the early colonial clergy. They preached equality because they believed in the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. They justified freedom by the text that we are all created in divine image. President Millard Fillmore, in December in 1852, said, our grateful thanks are due to an all-merciful providence. Our own free institutions are not the offspring of our revolution. They existed before. They were planted in the free charters of self-government under which the English colonies grew up. Other nations have had no such training for self-government, and every effort to establish it by bloody revolutions has been and must, without that preparation, continue to be a failure. Liberty unregulated by law degenerates into anarchy, which soon becomes the most horrid of all despotisms. We owe these blessings under heaven to the happy constitution and government which we bequeathed to us by our fathers and which our sacred duty to transmit to all their integrity to our children. Propaganda to weaponize psychology, declare anyone mentally ill who disagrees with us, redistribution of wealth, opposition to communism, opposition to gun control, man-made global warming, an apocalyptic event, AOC, opposition to one world government, belief in national sovereignty, belief in Christianity is the only true religion, hate speech laws against anyone who opposes their agenda or speaks against Islam or any other religion, as in Canada. This is a propaganda against anybody who believes that we have the right to free speech. Hitler killed 6 million Jews, 5 million non-Jews as a result of taking away this freedom. We have the Cloward-Piven strategy, which was a political strategy outlined in 1966 by American sociologists Richard Cloward and Francis Scott Bevin. They called overloading the U.S. public welfare system in order to participate in a crisis that would lead to a replacement of the welfare system with a national system of guaranteed annual income and thus an end to poverty. Well, Barack Obama was no fool. He was not incompetent. To the contrary, he was brilliant. He knows exactly what he's doing. He purposely overwhelmed the United States economy to create a system, systemic failure, economic crisis, and social chaos, thereby destroying capitalism and our country from within. Barack Obama was my college classmate in Columbia University, class of 83. As Glenn Beck correctly predicted from day one, Obama is following the plan of Cloward and Piven, two professors at Columbia University. They outlined a plan to socialize America by overwhelming the system with government spending and entitlement demands, which Biden and Harris have continued to do. And this is what we have. Individually, they're allowing the breakdown of American family through abortion, through homosexual agendas, through basically the Karl Marx and Hollywood and various other means to take away our freedoms, to break down morality through easy divorce. And for this, we will end our session. Thank you for listening.